This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
So my name is Jack Byrne. I'm a trans guy. I'm a human rights researcher. I'm from the west coast of the South Island, but I live in Auckland now, and I transitioned in Wellington. And I'm here with... I haven't got my hat on. I've seemed to have... lost that, but I'm here with the hat on of Counting Ourselves, which is our community-led trans and non-binary health and wellbeing survey that heaps of you filled out. This is was a community-led research project. The Jamie, who is the person who got the funding to be able to do it, as a trans woman. She really wanted to be here today, but she's been away from home for about 10 days and has some sick whānau members, so she had to fly home a little bit earlier. And then I came on board part-time to work on it. We've got a community advisory group, and our community advisory group has three people from here on it, Ahi, Jevon, and also B. There were three people who were Wellington-based. And they helped us come up with the questions and, more really importantly, help with the outreach to get people to fill in the survey. So I'd ask you to say if you filled it in, but it's an anonymous survey, so I won't do that. But I can tell you that Wellington was the place that totally overachieved, and you got more than your proportion of the population filled it out. 26% of our respondents were from Wellington. So, I don't know, you probably deserve a clap for that. And that means that we had responses from people all over the country, and most places it was about at the proportion of the population, except because you overachieved, everyone else is slightly underachieving for the proportion of the population. But The youngest that people could be was 14, and that was to get ethics approval, because we asked them really, as any of you who did it will know, there were tough questions in there about people who'd thought about suicide or attempted suicide. So 14 was the youngest we could get that we were allowed to ask, and the oldest person who filled it out was 83. So a huge, huge range of people, and the... regions, yeah, it was all over the country. The ethnicity mix, we overrepresented Pākehā overrepresented Māori slightly. It was a choice that we did that. Pacific, so about the proportion of the population, and Asian was slightly lower. Asian Pacific participants. So they are the four main groups we divided it into that we had enough people to report back on. And it's kind of hard too, because we don't know with the data about Asian participants whether that's also the proportion of Asian trans and non-binary people in New Zealand or not. We don't know if our proportions map the rest of the population in the same way. But we got enough to be able to say some things about the experiences of each of those groups that was slightly different from the others. We also, people with disabilities, huge proportion. A quarter of our participants had a disability. And we use this technical term, the Washington Group Short 6 questions. One of the ones we used, because it's what StatsNZ uses, so we can compare against the overall population. So that's why we used that. But we also asked about neurodiversity. And when you added the people with disabilities and those who are neurodiverse, it was about a third of our participants. So it's huge. We've got a lot of disability data that we can analyse, and I know there's people who are interested in being part of doing that. So I really wanted to thank everyone in Wellington who put such a huge effort in, because not only did you get so many people to fill it out, but also some of the resources we use, like Gender Minorities Aotearoa, you did put up posters about it around the country, and just to promote, you know, it. And we tried to, we used our resources and our social media stuff in places where we knew it was really hard to get. So we did we had posters up in Whangarei, on the East Coast, in Gisborne. Well, we were a little bit restricted from where Phantom had billboards, but we put posters up And we knew it was going to be harder to reach out to people who had transitioned a long time ago, who weren't so much on social media. But, you know, people like Karen and Piri Te Reo, who were based in Wellington for a long time, they really reached out through emails. People rang people to ask them to fill it out. And you could fill it out by hand, but we could send paper copies out. So now I'm just going to go move slightly over to where the laptop is. So Felicia Brown Acton is one of the community advisory group members, along with Ahi, people who just shared their words about why it was so important for people to fill out the survey. Then we also wanted this to be really robust, because we have got people that we're up against, obviously, at the moment. We need really robust data. So we got the survey reviewed to make sure it worked for our community, and we also talked to people in government agencies to look at the survey so they could give us some feedback, and health professionals. And it was live from 21st June, 2 days before my birthday, you can write that down if you want, till 30th of September. But a couple of people messaged me like at about 11:30 on the 30th of September. So to be honest, I let it stay open till about 10 a.m. on the 1st of October. But publicly, it was the 30th of September. We got 1,178 responses we could use. There were hardly any. We didn't have anyone maliciously trying to do something to it. We thought there might be. I think it was just too long. You'd have to have been really dedicated to have stuck with it to really stuff up our responses. But we did get some people who came in and then didn't come back, or came in and came back later. So there were people who did it multiple. So we cleaned all that out. So we started, you know, it was a bit bigger than that, but after we cleaned out all the multiple bits and that, 1,178, and lots of people spent a lot of time on it. I think the average was between 1 and 2 hours. So that's way, way too long for a survey, but we took out lots of questions at one point, and everyone kept saying put them back in. So I know it was a huge effort from people who filled it out, and there were some really heavy things there. So immensely grateful for people for doing that. And at one point we were trying to figure out the average, but we realised the person who just left their screen on for 4 days was stuffing up our average, so we haven't got an average time. And you had to be trans and non-binary. You didn't have to use that word to describe yourself, but we had a number of questions that identified someone whose gender was different from their sex assigned at birth. So, and whatever word you use, and living in Aotearoa and aged 14 or over. And that was the ethnicity mix that I showed you there. We had a great, I was sharing some data with some people yesterday, and there's some wonderful quotes we've got where people, particularly Māori and Pacific people, talked about how their sense of their identity, that, you know, gender was part of it, but it was only a part of who they were, and that there was the cultural context that supported who they were. I haven't got it on this one, sorry, but we've got some wonderful quotes in the report. These were some ones that were, I can tell, this was a presentation for some health providers, but for Pacific people, there were, you know, amongst our community, I guess I could say some of the hard stuff, there were more people who had been faced rejection from their families. So besides people, some people saying there was a lot of cultural support, there were other people talking about the hard stuff. And for our Asian Pacific participants, one of the biggest thing was racism, and particularly in public places. They were the group most likely to report racism in public places. I'll move on to some of the others. That was the regions, which I already told you about. But those were the words that people could give. You probably can't see it from a distance, but you had a long list you could put for your gender, and non-binary was by far the most common. Well, it was the most common one after, with transgender just below it, but 40% of people identified as non-binary. And then lots who just identified as male or female, trans men, trans women, and, you know, then we get to genderqueer, gender fluid. The word that was a non-English word that people most likely to use, the most common, was takatāpui. So 4% of people used takatāpui. And we had some other Pacific and Māori words. But this question here, the word cloud, is we asked people if there was a, from their cultural background, was there a term that was used to describe people like them? And those were the names there. Most of the ones you can see, the bigger ones, are Māori or Pacific terms, but there's a few other from other languages as well. The main point from this one is that our non-binary and our transmasculine participants were more likely to be younger, and our trans feminine participants, on the average mix, they were more likely to be a little bit older. So, you know, and this, we've grouped people into these three groups because for some of the gender-affirming care, the questions, you know, we want to know the differences between transmasculine, transfeminine people. Most of the time, we can also divide the non-binary people. It's about 3/4 of the non-binary people were assigned female at birth. So our community who answered this survey is more assigned female at birth than assigned male at birth. But that, we don't know if that's the mix or whether that's the people we were able to reach. But it was harder to reach people who had transitioned a long time ago, but there are also people who transitioned a long time ago who filled it out. So this mix does kind of seem very similar to some surveys from Australia and the US in recent times. We can break it down more, but you can just see, you know, there were very few of the age groups. Our youth are 14 to 24 on this. Then our older people are people like me, age 55 plus. So there's not that many of us at all, and a big chunk then also in that middle group. If anyone's got any questions as we're going, just, you know, shout out, or we can do some at the end. So I already mentioned the disability data, and this is an interesting one. In this measure about disability, there's 6 things that get measured, and we were the only one that, and people got counted if they have, cannot do or have a lot of difficulty with any of these 6 things. And we were higher for all of those except for hearing, and I think that probably is partly because our group is younger, and a lot of people who would tick that might be age-related hearing impairments. We were much bigger on a couple of them, and the one that was the biggest was reporting a lot of difficulty or could not concentrate or remember. And we've talked to a couple of disability activists, and people wonder whether that's actually related to the stress on our psychological distress on our communities. Because unfortunately, this measure of disability doesn't differentiate between whether it's something that you have always had or is likely to continue to have for the rest of your life, or that's something that may be happening to you at this particular point in time. But really, you know, 18% of our participants said that they have a lot of difficulty or could not concentrate or remember, and that's compared to 2% in the overall population. Now, I'm not going to go into so much detail on all the slides because this was for a much bigger presentation and I don't want to bore you, and maybe we want to talk more about activism and action and all the results. But all of the types of gender-affirming care, we asked you questions about all of them, and there's huge levels of unmet need for all of them. The one where there was the least unmet need, you know, that people wanted something but couldn't get it, that was access to hormones. And that's because, partly because of the cost, that once you get onto them, they're cheaper compared to anything else we're trying to get. But still, almost 20% of people wanted to get on hormone treatment and couldn't. And the biggest one was chest reconstruction surgery. And the reason why that was the biggest level of unmet need is because I think it was 99% of transmasculine people assigned female at birth who answered this survey wanted chest reconstruction surgery. Like, it was a really high proportion wanted it, and lots can't get it, so we've got a huge proportion of unmet need. For trans women, the biggest one was an unmet need for voice therapy and for lower surgery, feminising genital surgery. Cost for all of them was the biggest barrier, and hardly any, the only ones that any decent amount of people had ever been able to, had been able to get it through the public health system was hormones, counselling support and mental health assessment. Everything else were much, much, very unlikely that people had received through the public health system. And even for things like that, people who wanted it didn't know how to get it in terms of like things like counselling. These images, so you know those first images show people talking and saying, please fill out the survey. When we came to, and sometimes they were like, you know, quite passionate ones about the things that need to change. And then we wanted to have some uplifting images in the final report. So we asked Juliana just to imagine that we had things the way we wanted. So this is someone turning up somewhere and we've got our posters on the wall and it kind of feels like it's a little bit more welcoming. So that's that image. And you know, the quotes are around things like the cost of hair removal, places where it's just impossible to get access to anything. That's about to change in Christchurch. They've had a wonderful mix of health professionals in the community coming together, and it's going to be announced before the end of the year that they've actually got some trans health pathways. Ironically, maybe as some of the other pathways in the country we're struggling to keep open, but you know, they've got ones happening in Christchurch. And then people talking about the really positive things of getting on tea. So for each area we had recommendations, and we didn't make up the recommendations, we went and looked at things that other people had already been saying in other documents. And so this is actually, we just need real informed consent models, we need to be able to get access to all types of gender-affirming care, training for people, and also really specifically that we need kaupapa Māori and Pacifica models of services available. And this was one of the examples of, you know, this person's holding out how to access gender-affirming care in your region. You know, that's the wish, that in every part of the country you go somewhere. They probably wouldn't give it to you in paper. They'll probably give you the link, but it's kind of hard to draw a link online in an image. But that's the hope, that we need that. But currently most parts of the country, clinicians can't even find where they're meant to refer people to, let alone people in the community. And I know you've just announced stuff here really recently, which is great. So this one, you know, there's gaps in what health providers know. And this one, about 13% of participants have been asked unnecessary or invasive questions. And I love that when I was at a conference yesterday that Kate and Molly came to, like, already when you're there, people are using the data. Like, that's what it's here for. Please use these, this stuff. If you want to make sure you've got the prettiest graphs, if you want to go online, because there's a few that we've tweaked since they were in the report, but yes, please use the data, take it places. You know, people not going to access care because they worried that they'd be treated with disrespect, and that was 20% in the past 12 months hadn't gone. And so then it was about, you know, training for all types of health professionals. And we specifically put residential care facilities there. We did have a few people in aged care facilities who filled out the survey, but we also identified it as a group that's going to get bigger. And, you know, Silver Rainbow in Auckland, that's the group that goes and does training in aged care facilities, when they can get in there, you know, share examples of that. You know, some people, it's maybe a partner has passed, they've now gone into care. Maybe that's the first time they can think about transitioning. And so, you know, their organisation actually has had people approaching them in aged care facilities about wanting to transition. So, you know, needing training there as well. And that was one of those positive ones, you know, finally found a good GP tick. So this is the ones, you know, the data around suicide, psychological distress and violence. So obviously if anyone just doesn't want to read it, listen to the stuff or watch it now, you know, there's no worries, feel free to, you know, to leave or have a break, pretend you need to put money in a parking meter, whatever, come back if you want. But just wanting to give people that chance. And you've probably seen these because, you know, it's been in the media. This is some of the stuff we emphasised a lot. So, you know, 56%, more than half of our community, the people who answered the survey, had seriously thought about suicide in the last 12 months, and 12% had attempted. So that's not a surprise to our community, but it's still very stark to see it. And then 37% had ever attempted suicide. And we know that the level of stress on our community and that the impact that has on people's lives. We did a particular, the psychological distress, it's a scale and it measures predominantly around depression and anxiety. And this is the one here, where people were on this. And our community is the high or very high, these two bottom ones, if you add them together, that's quick math, 71%. Compared to it was actually 8% with the rounding for the overall population. But basically, our community is 9 times more likely to experience high or very high psychological distress. And we know that, you know, about minority stress. When you come from a community that's marginalised, isolated, has all that stigma and discrimination, this is what it looks like. But we've got some other slides around the protective things that make a difference. And there are, you know, things that really do make a difference. And so many of the things that are placating that stress are things that other people should be getting their shit together around, like waiting lists when people need to access care, and people affirming and supporting us. And so the recommendations, these ones pretty much came from the Rainbow Mental Health, Mental Health and Addictions Inquiry, and there was a large... lots of community groups filled out a rainbow submission, and you know they were the experts. They were the people working in this area. So it's Moira Cloutey, who wrote that submission. They spoke to it recently, and it's three words. The first is name us, name our community as a priority. The second one is train all those people working in mental health about our community and the support we need. And the other one is obviously resourcing. Resourcing, often some of the best initiatives coming from our communities, but resourcing for people working with our communities. And the substance use, but really the only main one was cannabis use is a bit higher, but I think there are some other ones there. Actually, no, but this cannabis one's the biggest one. But the other, so these are used near the following drugs. So actually, they're all a bit higher. The one, just so noticed that Jamie mostly talked about the cannabis one. We were trying, with the quotes in the report, we haven't put a judgmental thing about people's use. So someone there saying marijuana use helps significantly with my anxiety. So... but there was a bit more. There's more data that people working in that area would like to look at it. Quite a lot about people actually positively saying that when they transitioned, that was actually when they kind of sat down and got support and talked to other people around alcohol and drug issues. So for some people, transition was kind of a very much linked in, and those two journeys were very linked. Schools. So we already know from... the Youth 12 survey, we already knew data about young people, and our data pretty much is very similar to the Youth 12, normally a little bit worse, but pretty much the same, about the really high rates of bullying against our community. So this was, ours was 21% had been bullied at school at least once a week, and the Youth 12 data showed 19%, and that's compared to the Youth 12 measured for cisgender secondary school students. It was only 5%. And we had 93 secondary school students. It's almost exactly the same, pretty much around the same numbers as Youth 12, their data's from as well. It's interesting that our students are predominantly non-binary or transmasculine. Very few identified as trans woman or as trans feminine, most identified as those other two words, and lots of other words as well. and the positive support you can get from a counsellor, and really, really concerning story about sharing of photos of her genitalia at a school trip. And actually that's one of the areas of bullying that was particularly experienced by trans women was cyberbullying. So I don't know if I've got that statistic here, but that was a difference for trans women. And there were positive examples of what's happening at school, but it seems quite sporadic, or people saying we used to have a group. It's not, it shows, there's still a lot to happen, a lot needs to happen in schools, but people did give positive examples too. And then, once again, we looked at all the groups that have been doing work in schools and mirrored their things around comprehensive sexuality and gender diversity education, have rainbow diversity groups, address bullying, inclusive policies and practices, and making sure they deal with things, some of which are under attack at the moment, like the stuff about single-sex schools, people's right to attend single-sex schools, ability to access whether it's a bathroom based on their gender or a gender-neutral one, and changing rooms. So, they're the areas where we need more guidance. And one of the really nice things being in Christchurch last week, where we talked about that, there were people there who talked about, I don't know if you'd seen it in the media, Christ College is, supported, very, traditional boys-only school supporting a trans girl to transition there. Yeah. The main thing that we said about sport is that really it's a health issue too. All the media stuff has been around, trying to police trans women participating in sport, but people haven't been focusing so much on the issues around all genders that we looked at, people were less likely to participate in sport, and that's a real health and well-being issue. There weren't many positive examples of sport. There were a couple, people who'd been supported when their teammates and their club had supported them, when someone else had complained, but mostly it was the difficulties in sport. So the discrimination one, two-thirds had experienced discrimination at some point in their lives. And if you had experienced discrimination, you were twice as likely to have attempted suicide in the last year. So that's, we've pulled out that data to show, clearly the link between minority stress, discrimination, and the impacts on our health and suicide attempts. And lots of people didn't disclose at work, 57%. They worried about being discriminated against, and they didn't tell other people at work that they were trans or non-binary. And so this recommendation was, like we all know, like trans and non-binary people are protected under the ground of sex in the Human Rights Act, but it doesn't explicitly say gender identity or gender expression. It's important to have that. But we also need resources. So if you do get shit at school, at work, in any other environment, you can actually say, look, there's this material that says you can't do that. Like if the government's going to say we're already covered, we'll put some teeth behind it and some information behind it so it's not up for question. So that's the training and resources. And then we particularly put one there around police because we had some data about people's experiences with police. And so that was one group that particularly needed some training. We did ask people about experiences in prison, but the number of people wasn't large enough for us to be able to break down that data. So I think, there weren't enough people who were in prison. We tried to get into prison to get people to fill it out, but it weren't possible to do that. It was hard because it was mostly online, and it's really hard. People in prison don't have access to online surveys, but other attempts weren't successful. But the safety and violence is the other hard stuff, This is a really clunky question. Did someone try to have sex with you against your will since you were 13? The reason we asked it is because we had some data. Someone else has asked it at another survey, so we could compare us to the overall population. So a third of us, almost 32%, someone had had sex with us against our will since we were 13. And that's more than four times the overall population. That figure was higher for trans women, trans men, non-binary. All of us, each of those groups, have experienced that type of rape and abuse more than women overall in the population or men overall in the population. And if you had experienced that, you were twice as likely to have attempted suicide in the past year than people who didn't report that. So it's like, these are the things that need to be addressed, you know, discrimination, violence against our communities, to be able to protect us and our health and our well-being. And this one here about, you know, someone was 14-year-old and had nowhere to go. Well, there was no place within their school to be able to talk about an abusive relationship. And they said, surprisingly, only got those answers when I approached my local youth group. Not ideal that I had to join a church to get sex education. So that's to get information about what is abuse and what isn't. And people's concerns about whether, as a non-binary person, they would be able to access a rape crisis centre. So the need for, you know, clearly inclusive services. And, you know, that's, again, it's actually having the services that recognise our specific experiences and also training and guidance for all agencies. And some wonderful things, like people from HELP in Auckland came to our launch in Auckland. Like there are you know, people working in the sector who are really keen to work and support our communities. The identity documents, hardly any of us have got our correct gender on our birth certificate. 83% of us haven't. So that was, you know, an important one that we've conveyed to the minister who's looking at changing birth certificates. And so we just, you know, clearly stood in support of the campaigns in the community. There's someone filling out submission around the bill and the need to provide a non-binary, you know, the biggest group in our community are non-binary people, and we have no non-binary option on birth certificates. So the need for non-binary gender marker option, accessible administrative process based on self-declaration. We've also got this one about the recommendation about trans and non-binary refugees and asylum seekers. We had people who are refugees and asylum seekers who filled out our survey, and that recommendation's come from, it's already been made in other spaces. You can't change your name in New Zealand unless you're a permanent resident, and you can't change your gender on any document until your refugee claim has been accepted. So, and many people who come here seeking asylum will never be able to change documents in the country they come from. The material hardship one, there's two other measures in this, but these are the four main ones, but on all of the measures of material hardship, there was a lot more material hardship in our community. So this is measured in the general social survey. So in the last 12 months, have you done any of the following things to keep costs down? And we had done things like, you know, cut back on trips to go to shops or local places, repairing things, putting up with feeling cold, gone without fresh fruit or vegetables. So those are questions that are used to measure material hardship. And the group that was the most likely to experience that was people with disabilities, so amongst our communities. And family whānau, a positive one. If people are told that someone in their family that they were trans or non-binary, more than half said, 57%, that said that most or all of the people they told were supportive. So, and if you were supported by at least half of your family or whānau, you are almost half as likely to have attempted suicide in the last 12 months. So that means, you know, that family support is a protective factor for us. And and there was, you know, people's experiences have been totally cut off from family through to people who've found a place for themselves and their family. I like this one. Just remembering now I'm meant to be reading things out for the audio, so I'll read this one out. My pronouns and gender identity don't translate well into my cultural world, so when talking about my pronouns, it can get tricky, but I found a peace within myself around that, and I'm okay with it. And other people, you know, cut off. Did I put, I'll just see whether, I didn't put it here, but, oh, just quite a lot of us appearance. So I liked that, and the section on that, I'll just find it. And the other bit was quite a lot want kids as well. So I have to take my glasses off to read that. Yes. Almost one in five people, 19%. Oh no, I'll start with the ones. I can't find the one that says how many are parents, but 4% had been pregnant since identifying as trans or non-binary. One in six people were parents, 16%. And almost one in five, 19% of people were definitely like a child or more children. And the thing that was really interesting is that Māori were much more likely. So almost a third of our Māori participants were definitely like a child or more children. So, it was one of the things that I know people from the Honour Project Aotearoa were interested in. Cultural connectedness, or community connectedness. So I am proud to be trans or non-binary person. We had a third of us strongly agreed with that, and another 29 somewhat agreed. So that's over half of people to some extent agreed with, I am proud to be trans or non-binary person. And I think it's really important we say that, because I was in a presentation this morning where someone, a health professional who's really supportive generally, said no one chooses to be trans, and why would you choose to be trans when you look at all of this, these negative statistics? And I think while that's the experience of some people, that it doesn't feel like a choice to them, it feels like, you know, born this way, for some other people there's a very active, actually, I grab this and I run with it and I'm really, really happy about it and I'm proud. So there's a mix of things there. So I think whilst saying that some of this just feels like it's there, it's who you are, I don't think we have to deny the pride that we have, and either individually or in our community. So And you know, we're a community under stress, but we're doing a hell of a lot of support for each other. 58% provided a lot of support for other trans or non-binary people, and almost the same, felt connected to others. And I know that the people who felt connected are more likely to see the survey, but I still think, you know, it's positive to see that. Here's a Wellington one. Yeah. I feel very connected to the trans community in Wellington through volunteer work. Maybe that's at the op shop. It's important to me that young trans folk never have to deal with any of the internalised issues that held me back from coming out for so long. Then harder for someone in a small town. I don't really get to meet other queer people, let alone trans or MB people. It's a bit isolating. And people really valuing that there are other people that are very visible. And also that comment, I'm so tired, and I understand that one. That's probably why I lost my mobile phone today. Yeah. So these are some of the differences. I think I've gone through some of those, the higher rates of mental health issues for young and disabled participants. Disabled people also higher rates of discrimination, violence and hardship. Non-binary were less likely to report positive experiences when they were accessing healthcare. Often there was real concerns about not being understood, not being believed, by health professionals. And trans men and trans women were more likely to say that, you know, since identifying as trans, quality of life had improved. That was less common with non-binary people. I've talked about Asian and Pacifica participants. And when we looked at everyone who wasn't European, everyone who wasn't Pākehā, if If you had a strong sense of belonging to your ethnic group, you are less likely to have considered suicide in the last 12 months. So this is the beginning of us starting to look at some of the data about connection to culture and how that supports people's health. And we're about to do some work. Next week we're spending half a day in a hui on a project, Aotearoa, to sit down and look at the data they've collected about takatāpui and cultural connectedness and the material we've got, and see if together they can support each other in painting a picture. And this is like resource peer support and other wellbeing initiatives that are led by our communities, and including those developed by disabled people, Māori and Pacifica peoples, Asian and other ethnic minorities, and refugees and asylum seekers. So the people doing the work within particular parts of our community, that's where we need to get the resources. And this image has got a trans flag at the back and a picture of lots of different trans and non-binary people, and maybe some of their family, who knows, of different ages and ethnicities, and that wonderful poster at the background, trans people have always existed. So that was us. Our project team, I'm trying to see who there. All of us are based in Kirikiriroa or in Auckland. Some of you know Tommy because he lived here for a long time. Tommy provided lots of safety and support. We had a little phone that I carried in case the people, there was a number on the survey that people could ring us at any point in time. We didn't have a big budget, so it was the cheapest phone we could get at the Warifari, and it was really hard to use, but I think I only ever got 2 calls on it, but we had it there as a backdrop, and he was there for support around how we phrased the questions. So I said B, and Ty was as well, as he's based here in Wellington. B, Ty, Jevon, and Ahi, all here from Wellington, are in the community advisory group. Karen's name is listed there, cisgender ally, who did our editing of the report and put lots and lots of time into that. And thank you to anyone who sent us comments about how we could sort of make the questionnaire better. And you can get a hold of, is this the end of your ones, Ahi? The ones out here? So you've got a couple, like 2 here that are left from your box that you had. And I've got about, I think I've got about 10, maybe 12 copies of the report. And particularly we want them to go to people and organisations who can use them, but you can also find it online, and I've got a hand up. Kay, what's the question?
You may have covered this, Jack, but I can't remember. Was sexual orientation in the survey as well? Because I can imagine that would be another area of issues for some people more than others.
Yeah, we've got the sexual orientation data. We're going to need to do more analysis of it, because we didn't just ask people, we asked people, all of the people that they were attracted to. So it's a sexual attraction question mostly, and so it's not as simple, because we just thought, partly we asked it that way because we knew from other surveys and other things that we'd done that often you would get, for example, a trans woman who identifies the gender as female, identifies that she has sex with men, and writes down her sexual orientation as gay in other surveys. And we've had, so we just thought if we just, we wanted to get more into the mix of it. So yes, we've got data, but it's quite complex that we haven't analysed yet. But we've also got heaps of data. We asked people, has your sex life changed in any way since you identified as trans or non-binary? And that's really interesting in terms of people's relationship to their bodies, both the hard stuff and the really good stuff. Quite a few some trans people saying having a relationship with another trans person is one of the most affirming things they've had. And that to be seen as fully as who you are, whoever it's by, is the best sexual experiences that they ever had. And then also the stuff about the impact of discrimination on, you know, for some people it made it harder to find partners. So it's complex. So that's more about partners. That's more about sex and sexual behaviour. And then we've got a lot of data about sexual attraction. But I can't tell you how many, right off the top of my head now, identified as a different label, because we just kind of thought that was too simplistic to explain it. So we've got more work, and I guess that introduces me to that other thing, is that we've got lots more data. We'd love people in the community who want to help us analyse some of that data. Well, to write it up. We've got the data, we can analyse it, but then people saying, well, what does this mean? And whether that's going to be academic articles for people who are into doing that, or whether it's going to be creating community resources. Like I talked to Stace about what's the first disability resource we create, and getting together a group of people to talk about doing that. We haven't got much funding. Our funding's pretty much drying up now, but we've got a commitment to keep doing the work, and we're going to keep trying to find funding so that at least we can keep coordinating people to write things. And it's been great that people have created infographics already with stuff and are using it. But anyone else? Yeah?
Continuing that, one of the reasons why I asked that was the complexity of identifying mental health and addiction service needs, because the research that Frank Pegger and others did showed that by and pan communities have higher depression, mental health and addiction abuse issues than either gay or straight communities. So when you pile on top of that the gender identity issues, that you're going to have a really complex set of needs.
And I think it's one of those ones we just know, whatever the sexual orientation of people in our community, those rates are extraordinarily high, exorbitant. They're really worrying, concerning and need attention. And then we could drill down more below that. But, some of those particular things that are stress are ones that trans people will experience, and non-binary people, particularly those trying to access gender-affirming care, are going to, they're specific to not being able to get the health care that people are wanting. Yeah. Is there anyone else who had any questions?
Yeah. So the survey didn't focus specifically on something known as chemsex.
No,
because that definitely would be something worth studying, because I'm pretty sure there's a large proportion that use P quite regularly, unfortunately. Yeah. And it's based around them having sex while high. Yeah. That whole particular side of it is quite different.
Yeah, so I think we have got P as one of the people's use of it, is there.
And it's P and P.
Yeah.
In terms of, you can see it written out there.
Yeah.
It's just party and play. Run for the hills if you see it, but...
So, and I guess the only thing I could say is that for any of the questions, we can compare, how people answered one question with how they answered another one. So we could see if for people who are more likely to have answered that, whether there were the other. But the numbers are relatively small, so I don't know how much we would be able to tell. But that's the other thing we can do. We can, compare... There's lots more ways we can compare the data that we haven't done yet. And I guess it's just the final bit I'd say is really we wanted to use it as an activist tool. We can use the data about legal gender recognition just to show actually heaps of people are non-binary. We don't actually have that option at the moment. So no matter what you do to change the current process, it's not going to be good enough for a huge proportion of our community who identify as non-binary. We can use it to show just how much people are needing to access gender-affirming care and that's not being provided in their local DHB. We can, yeah.
I've got a question about this. It sounds like you said you've got a lot more data that could be analysed and put together in certain ways. I'm wondering at this stage, in your opinion, whether it would be better to, I imagine it might be better to really milk all the data that you've got to get the most out of it. How useful it would be if there were smaller studies done or regional stuff done to build a really
And other people like Ahi might have thoughts on this as too. I think, you know, like for ages we had our stories. You know, you wish that change happened from sharing the personal stories, but, you know, numbers does have impact as well. So this was about getting numbers. And then because we had open boxes where people could share things, and some people wrote heaps, so we've actually got stories there as well. I think we've got enough evidence now. I think it's actually about using it to bring about action. So even the bit about writing academic articles, for this, us that's about action, because some health professionals, if we want to change their behaviours, we have to get things published in medical journals. But if we want action on disability issues, for example, well, maybe the first priority is to get some of the resources available in an accessible form that people in the community will use. You know, like, it's whatever the action is, where change is needed, what is the most important thing. But I personally, you know, there's always lots of questions like the one you raised. You know, there's lots more we could ask, but there's enough, you know, there's such a long list of things we need to action already. I think we've got enough data. If you can't find it in the report, you wonder if there's something, just email us and we'll tell you if there is or not. But I'm really keen to hear what's the activism people are working on and what sort of... Because we asked people that before. What data do you need for your activism? That's why we had such a long survey. But now, is there, you know, if you're working on something, you need a few statistics for a submission. You know, I should know the report quite well. Feel free to email me and say, which pages do I find that on? Or there's people in this room, you know, who are doing that already. I think gender minorities could probably tell you it's on this page or that page. I don't know, what do you think, Ahi? You know, where do you think we are at that balance of needing more data, more surveys and action?
Yeah, I guess there's always more to know, definitely. And there's always more questions that we could have more things about, but I think that there's, like you said, there's heaps to work with here, so that's really cool. And I guess that the tricky thing is doing research really well. It takes so much time doing it for every question. I guess it's a huge process to get a simple, like in one of the reasons, housing survey for just the London region about like precarious housing over the last. It's like a 25 question survey, but it took us so much time, you know, and it's not perfect. So it's kind of, I think the real important thing is that if you're going to do research projects, you do them really, really well, so you get the data that's really useful and you don't waste people's energy, you know, giving you their stories about their lives, especially if you're asking them difficult stuff. I think, you know, more research is always good, and also, there's some heaps to pull out of this one.
And also, some of the research could be really linked to actions like, you know, finding out whether the service, the groups that we're running nowadays, are they meeting the needs of all of our communities? Or I was at a meeting on Friday morning where someone was reporting the results of data they've collected around the experiences of rainbow ethnic communities. Is it just in Auckland or is it all around the country? Camille's research. And they've got lots of material. I think it's mostly in Auckland. They still need funding to be able to do their transcripts. And some of that's about, you know, people don't go and use some of the services we already have. So maybe that's some of the stuff we do, how to improve what we've already got. And I think we've got the data. I think we need to be a bit. I'd love to find ways that we stay more coordinated with each other around the country. Like there's opportunities. You've finally got your what are they called? Your health pathway for gender affirming care is finally online here in Wellington. Is that true? So you put something on Facebook this week. Yeah. But, you know, some of the best practice is, you know, When the Canterbury ones come up, which is before the end of the year, they have done it in a way that you don't need to have been on hormones to access chest reconstruction surgery. First one in the country that's going to be on that. And that's huge for non-binary people. Let's, you know, just because they've got a pathway that says that, we all know that sometimes those pathways lead to shut doors, or a door that's open for a little bit of time and then it gets shut because there's no surgeon anymore. So I think if we're more coordinated and we can share what people have been able to achieve in each part of the country, then we can, you know, stand by each other. I'm just so proud of how we dealt with yesterday. You know, like, it was, you know, and the fact that you organised this, and you've had way more people through here today, you organised this, you've had way more people here today than people of a diverse range of ages and ethnicities and genders than who happened to go and listen to a very highly resourced meeting down the other end of town yesterday. We coordinated. They tried really hard to get a trans person on Nation, and we all said no. Like, that level of coordination amongst a community where some people would probably quite like to be on TV, we all still said no. You know, like, we're doing really well, I think, on our activism, and it's hard. So, I don't know, any other questions? It's the end of the day. Some of you have been here selling soaps or zines or bunting or whatever else all day, so I don't want to keep people, but, you know, I'd love us to be cool, you know, find ways to stay more coordinated and find out how. I'd love, actually that would be great, people tell us when, even simple as tell us if you use the stats in anything in presentations. Maybe I'll see if we can put up on our website somewhere where people can, a form that people can quickly send and tell us that they've done that. They are being used a lot around the country, yeah.
And here's another positive story. If you haven't already seen Tangata Pacifica television program, which did the Pacific Awards, it was on television this morning, it'll be online. At least two of the people who got awards were from the gender diverse communities, and everybody was clapping. So Carl Peloto Enderman was one of the people who won awards, and somebody for Lavar, and it was like everybody was supportive, and there were sort of bits of their stories, and like the reach of that type of thing within the Pacific communities is way bigger than any of these negativities that we're getting. It's just like, you know. So I think, you know, the more stories that are positive, the better it is for everybody.
And I think that also speaks to that the Pacific activists I know are doing, you know, we see them in our community coming to our events, you know, which are their events as well, but they're also doing so much within their own community around language or around fundraising or... and I think... For some of, I don't know, I just, yeah. How do we create those spaces? Because we're so busy creating the spaces for our community stuff to happen. How do we create the spaces where those people who support us can be there with us, but we're leading that space? And that's what I think this is. This is a trans and non-binary-led space, whatever words you used for, and it's a space where allies can come into, and I think we could do with a few. We don't really have that so much in Auckland. Yeah, I think you do some things remarkably well here. Yeah.
Actually, so this was put together by the youth team from Gender Matters, so all people, a lot of people who are 25 and under, and we actually thought maybe we might close up with Alex, might say.
Totally.
Kia ora, thanks for everyone coming. I'm Alex, this is Molly and Chase, and we're on the Gender Minorities Youth Team. And this is also Harry from the Newtown Community Centre, who's done a lot to support this event physically happening, and obviously Ahi from Gender Minorities as well. So this is the first event that we've like ever put on like this. It's the first kind of like formation of Gender Minorities Aotearoa youth team as a sort of thing, and we've been really surprised, to be honest, but very heartwarmed at like the success of this event, the positive reception we've had from both the trans community and allies that have kind of made it come together. So I just wanted to do a couple of thank yous. So firstly, thank you to Harry and everyone at the Newtown Community and Cultural Centre for kind of hosting us and giving us the opportunity to have this, because, yeah, we, as I say, like, most of us are just hiding in the little den at Auntie Dana's at most of the time, so it's nice to kind of, like, get out into the community. A thank you to all the stallholders for giving their time to support this great event. Some of them have left earlier and some of them are still here. Thank you to Ahi and to Gender Minorities Aotearoa for giving us the support and encouragement to put something like this on. I think it's kind of given us a space to kind of bring together as people and as friends. I'd like to say thank you to Jack, obviously, who just spoke, and everyone at Counting Ourselves for doing such vital work for our community, and we're very like honoured to be able to give them this space to kind of like promote that and discuss the implications for it, and obviously engage with the community responses here today. And just a general thank you to everyone that's attended, both presently and earlier. Supporting your trans youth means so much to us. It means as activists, but also as just people, as part of this community that, you know, can feel quite neglected and marginalised, knowing that there is such a positive reception to us and our work and our creations is really, really valuable. So yeah, a massive thank you to everyone. Hope you have a good evening and get home safe.